This is Boom Bust, broadcasting around the globe and covering the world of business and finance and the impact upon us all. I'm Daniel Brito.
And I'm Christy I in Washington. Here's a look at what's on deck today. The terms have been set for the EU-Mercosur trade deal, but it's far from over. Ruben Cortina, the president of UNI Global Union, joins us from Buenos Aires, Argentina, to bring down what's at stake in this deal. Plus, trade tensions may have cooled between the U.S. and China, but it's still a hectic highway for Huawei. RT's Alex Mihailovich and Brent Jabor are on hand to break it down.
And later, the roller coaster rages on for Bitcoin as the crypto has seen its ups and downs. And it's not just Bitcoin, as altcoins have also taken a beating. Ruby Morales of Outlier Ventures is standing by to dig into the details of the dip. We've got a packed show today, so let's head right in. A French roadblock for the trade deal between the European Union and Mercosur leads our global report today, as France signals it is not ready to approve. French Agriculture Minister Didier Guillaume told members of the French Parliament, quote, "We won't have an accord at any price. The story isn't finished." More specifically and more dramatically, Mr. Guillaume said, "I will not be the French minister who sacrifices French agriculture on the altar of an international agreement." Similarly, the French foreign minister said it remained to be seen whether France would support the deal. French President Emmanuel Macron hailed the draft agreement as a good deal after last Friday's landmark announcement following a full 20 years of negotiation between the EU and the South American trading bloc. A presidential spokesperson later said, quote, "France is not yet ready to ratify." And all these comments followed the statement of a 23 million member farmers union that the deal would be remembered as, quote, "a very dark moment." Here to dive into the details of this emerging story is Ruben Cortina, president of the UNI Global Union, which represents 20 million members in 150 countries, joining us from Buenos Aires. President Cortina, welcome to Boom Bust. And Mr. Cortina,
Your
union represents workers in the Mercosur nations, Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, and Uruguay, as well as in the EU. How do you see this agreement affecting those different constituencies of your membership, and what is the union's position on this agreement right now?
Well, as you said, I represent globally a union that has constituencies all around the planet, including European Union and Latin American unions. So the visions that are going on through this discussion with this, these, I would say, pre-agreement are different. Obviously, there are a lot of unions in the European Union that are against the agreement, mostly those unions that are related to agricultural production. And there are other unions that think that this agreement can bring more jobs to the European Union. In the other end, the Mercosur unions historically are against these type of agreements, these trade agreements, as we call them, being them bilaterals or multilaterals or bi-regional like this one, because history demonstrates that free trade agreements do not necessarily bring jobs, welfare, good salaries for our people. So these different visions have to be discussed in the future. Why do I say this? Because the agreement is not signed yet. It's just an intention that both parts have to go on a process that is not yet finished. And that's what you said about the French opinion. The opinion of the French people, mostly the people related to agricultural policies, are against the agreement. So there's a lot to go on yet on this agreement because they also have to go through parliaments. So I think that we just saw a sign of, I would say, a declaration or something like that. That's what I said. This was just a pre-agreement.
And now, what are the sectors that will be the most affected by this agreement, and in what way?
Well, in our case, as non-industrialized countries, except a little bit more than Argentina, Brazil, industry, light industry and manufacturers will be severely damaged. Textile, shoemakers, car makers, all those industries that we have in our countries trying to develop through the years can be seriously damaged. That is why in our side the negotiations took 20 years and will take some more years. But I think that countries that have this economic profile of being countries that only builds their economy on exportation of primary goods and are not totally industrialized, like some of the European countries, we will be severely damaged through the years.
And in terms of process, clearly this will take some time. President Bolsonaro of Brazil suggested 1 to 3 years before the agreement could be approved. What is your estimate?
Well, I think so. I also think that it's going to take a while because the agreement, once it's signed, finally signed, it has to go to parliamentary approval. In the case of the European Union, maybe that parliamentary approval can be avoided because the European Union has supranational tools that allows the European Commission to go to avoid the process in the parliaments, the national parliaments and the European parliaments. But in the case of Mercosur, it has to go through our four national parliaments, that is the Brazilian, the Paraguayan, the Uruguayan, and the Argentinian parliament. And by the way, we are having electoral processes here in our country, in Argentina, and also in Uruguay, and we don't know what's the outcome of these processes, so we don't know what the real composition of the parliaments will at the end be. So I think it will take a lot of time, to get this agreement through our legislation and through our national realities.
So on the subject of Brazil, last month your union wrote to President Bolsonaro on the subject of labor rights. What did you say?
Well, we are deeply engaged with the reality that our unions are living in Brazil. Since the Temer presidency and now with Mr. Bolsonaro, the reality of our union movement and workers is getting worse day by day. They have thrown away legislation that was in place since 1940 about the resourcing of the unions. They are talking about labor reforms, and they have already put in place labor reforms that really damages the outcome of the union activity in Brazil. Unions in Brazil are going through a very, very worry present, very, very difficult situation in terms of their own resourcing and talking and engage with a struggle with the government because of the labor reforms government is putting in place that goes against workers and unions.
Mm-hmm. And just one last question very quickly. President Bolsonaro suggested the EU-Mercosur deal, even as it is in process, could spur a domino effect of other trade deals, perhaps most immediately with Japan. Do you think that will happen?
I don't think so. I think that there is a speed, global speed on these trade agreements since the 90s. And mostly since 2005. So I think that I don't think that this bi-regional agreement, in case it is put in place, legally put in place, can bring more speed to other agreements that could take place. We'll see what happens in the near future, but I don't think that this will begin a round of new trade agreements around the world because of this bi-regional agreement.
Thank you so much. Ruben Cortina, president of the UNI Global Union.
The Brazilian Senate has recommended that the chief financial officer and former CEO of the Vale Corporation be indicted for manslaughter over a deadly dam collapse that killed 350 people. Vale, the world's largest producer of iron ore and nickel, has been under scrutiny since a precarious dam holding back mining waste collapsed near the town of Brumadinho in the state of Minas Gerais in January. Now, after a series of public hearings over 120 days, a Senate committee has recommended 16 indictments on manslaughter and other crimes. 14 of the recommended indictments are against individuals and 2 against corporations, including Vale. The former Vale CEO cited by the committee is Vale Shortman, who stepped down in March. The committee's findings do not obligate prosecutors to charge the targets, but will certainly add to the public pressure for action. Despite a truce in the trade war between the United States and China and President Donald Trump's decision to allow U.S. companies to sell tech to Huawei, the Chinese telecom giant's founder, Ren Zhengfei, doesn't think that it will have much of an impact on their business. In a statement issued to the Financial Times, Mr. Ren said of the situation, "President Trump's statements are good for American companies. Huawei is also willing to continue to buy products from American companies. But we don't see much impact on what we are currently doing. We will still focus on doing our own job right." Joining us now to dig deep into what this reprieve from the U.S. means for Huawei is RT America correspondent Alex Mihailovich and Boom Bust producer Brent Jabor. So first off, Alex, what are the concerns that Huawei has over this reprieve in the ban on American companies selling tech, specifically semiconductors, to the Chinese telecom giant?
Well, look, Ren Zhengfei has pretty much said it all. He's welcoming this news from Trump, but he's taking it with a grain of salt. He knows that the way the U.S. operates, there's going to be a lot of opposition to loosening anything with Huawei because of so-called security concerns, especially coming from China hawks in the U.S. government. So one step forward, he's saying, you know what, we're going to keep doing business as usual. As you just mentioned, we want to do things right. That's what Huawei is doing, and that's where they want to stand. Now, working with U.S. companies would be absolutely great. We know that these companies sell software as well as chips and other goods to Huawei. They've worked in combination. American companies, obviously, that have worked with Huawei want to keep doing business with Huawei because it means money for them. But at the same time, Huawei says, well, you know, there's other places that have that kind of stuff, and we can go to other countries. We even believe in our own Chinese industry to be able to produce what the Americans can. And here's the problem. Once you lose this type of client, it's really difficult to get that client back. So that's the problem that the U.S. is going to see. But here is what the CEO and founder of Huawei said. Here's a quote from him, which is quite interesting, that the U.S. is helping us in a great way by giving us these difficulties. Under external pressure, we have become more united than ever. So what the Huawei chief executive is basically saying here is that, you know what, we've gone to these other places, we've had to be resilient, we've had to diversify, we're working with other people now, and you know what, we're here, we're not going away. There's plenty of countries that use our product. So with or without the U.S., we're just going to keep chugging along. And sure, we'd love to work with the U.S. There is that possibility. And with what President Trump is saying, of course, this means more business for everybody. But as I mentioned, there's going to be a lot of opposition coming from within the U.S. government.
Now, Brent, in May, Google temporarily banned Huawei phones from receiving updates for their Android operating system, only to turn around and give the company a temporary 90-day stay, which allows tablets and phones running Android to receive the updates until mid-August. Now that there is a truce in the trade war and the restrictions against Huawei have been relaxed, what does this mean for Huawei's use of the world's most popular mobile operating system?
It's actually very interesting because Huawei itself doesn't actually know what this means for their use of the Android operating system. I want to talk about a quote myself. Tim Danks, Huawei's Vice President of Risk Management and Partner Relations, was asked about this on Monday, and he said, quote, "We acknowledge President Trump's comments related to Huawei over the weekend and will wait for guidance from the Department of Commerce, but have nothing further to add at this time." And the U.S. Commerce Department has actually not responded to this as of yet. And now, as we mentioned, Huawei has until mid-August to use Android to work out their own system. Android did that because what they wanted was to secure it so that way they weren't using unupdated versions that were outdated and were vulnerable to any sort of issues. Now, they also said there's a couple of things to note here. And according to a report from the South China Morning Post recently, Huawei has actually been working on their own proprietary operating system codenamed Ongmeng since 2012. And in the event that this exact situation would have happened, when asked about it, they essentially say they prefer to use Android for mobile and Windows for their PC, but they have to protect the interests of their customers. And they've even started to court some of Google Play Store's app developers to be published on their own marketplace. So that's what they're working with. Now, just something to remind you of, in China, they use a really pared down version of the Android operating system that uses a backbone, but it's not the latest, greatest version. But whether that would work in the West, where we want the latest and greatest type of technology, it's hard to see. So that's kind of up in the air.
And Brent, on that point, since Huawei is working on their own operating system, what does that mean for Google's suite of apps native to Android that might not then be available on this new system?
It's very interesting because you may remember back when Android was kind of coming to prominence and iOS was their big competitor, the Apple operating system. There was a situation between the two companies where Apple didn't want Google apps, Google didn't want to let Apple use their apps, and so what happened was you didn't have Google Maps, which is the number one when GPS was becoming a big thing with smartphones. And so what happened was Apple had their own maps, Apple Maps, that became disastrous, sending people everywhere but their own destination. Public outcry happened, and guess what? Google Maps ended up on the system. So this could be a situation if Huawei did their own proprietary system in the West. But again, you got to look at Huawei's biggest market of China. All of the Google apps are actually blocked in the country without the use of some sort of VPN. And so as it is now, it could easily, you know, prop up some of China's biggest sites and apps. For example, I want to take a look at a couple of videos streaming and hosting sector companies. So in the West, the market is dominated by YouTube, which boasts about 2 billion monthly users. But there are some giants in China that most Westerners have never heard of. For instance, there's Yugu, which is roughly 500 million monthly users and is owned by China's largest company in Alibaba. There's also Qiyi, which is a streaming site that has around 500 million monthly users and is owned by the Google of China, Baidu. And finally, there's Tencent Video, of course, owned by Chinese multimedia conglomerate Tencent, and averages about 900 million monthly users. Now, think about this. If you know, Huawei is making their presence felt in the West. If they were to start using their own operating system and these types of apps were native, they could start to compete with YouTube, and that could be a big deal.
And Alex, with this situation seeming to finally have some sort of clarity, what does it mean for Huawei CFO Meng Wanzhou, who of course was arrested in Vancouver in December at the request of United States authorities?
Well, as it stands right now, Meng, her lawyers here in Canada, what they've basically been saying is that, you know, this whole thing is without merit. And that's being backed up by some of President Trump's suggestions when he's saying, you know, this whole Meng thing might go away. We might stop the whole extradition process if we get a deal with China. So as you can imagine, the lawyers are jumping on that, as well as in some political circles here in Canada. So former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien, he's also one of the people pushing forward, saying that, you know what, it might be time to let Meng go, simply because we want to better our relations. That's what he's saying. The Canadians want to better their relations with China, the second biggest trading partner. And also the third, Justin Trudeau, I mean, he can't really do very much at this point. But if it ever did come to extradition, that's when the Prime Minister could come in, talk to his Minister of Justice and say, hey, okay, we need to stop this. That would be far down the road. But right now there does seem some movement and some people talking about letting Meng go.
RT correspondent Alex Mihailovic and RT producer Ren Jabor. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Time now for a quick break, but stay tuned because when we return, the roller coaster rages on for Bitcoin as the crypto has seen its ups and downs. And it's not just Bitcoin, as altcoins have also taken a beating. Rumi Morales of Outlier Ventures is standing by to dig into the details of the dip. And as we go to break, here are the numbers at the close.
This is a sticker from a water bottle found in the stomach of a fish. The brand is part of the Coca-Cola Company, which sells millions of bottles of soda every day.
The idea was that let's tell consumers they're the bad ones. They're the litter bugs. They're throwing this away. Industry shouldn't be blamed for all this waste.
The company has long promised to reuse the plastic.
On a un document en fait des traces écrites de Coca qui nous explique dans un échange de mail que en fait c'est uniquement 7% de plastique recyclé contenu en moyenne dans les bouteilles au niveau mondial, sachant que l'objectif en 2015 était 25%.
Aujourd'hui, on a une nouvelle stratégie et une nouvelle politique.
But for now, the mountains of waste only grow higher.
In a world of fake partisan news, lies, and conspiracy,
it's time to wake up, to dig deeper, to hit the stories that mainstream media refuses to tell. More than ever, we need to be smarter. We need to stop slamming the door on the facts and shouting past each other. It's time for critical thinking. It's time to fight for the middle, for the truth. The time is now for watching closer, for watching the Hawks.
Я сюда приехал попробовать нырнуть на пределе своих возможностей. Я не люблю холод. Это как бы небольшой такой вызов. Попробовать как нырять в ледяной воде.
Вот да.
Тут парень, который побил мировой рекорд, нырнул 75 метров. Мне надо нырять 76.
3, 2, 1. Старт.
Over the last 48 hours, Bitcoin has had a 30% correction following a very strong rally that has been in play over the last few months. Now, as exciting as it would be to watch it just go parabolic, we needed these periods of consolidation. As Bitcoin fell, we see some very strong support at the 10,000 range. As soon as it was breached, it was met with heavy buyers, bringing it right back up. You see the rising candlesticks on the hourly, which is a very good sign, but presently, the 5-day and 10-day moving averages crossed over, indicating that short-term momentum is to the downside. So there is a bit of selling pressure and volatility to wade through as we go back and retest those support levels at 9,000 for a third and hopefully the last time. The altcoins have also shed their values as most are correlated to Bitcoin, but we have some pockets of strength where they really shined. We have Holochain, BitTorrent, Komodo, V-Systems, and BAT, all decoupling from Bitcoin and rallying higher. So you see a slight rotation in some of these altcoins here, but this is not the full liquidity exit yet. And while we love looking at technicals for crypto trading, let's take a look at some of the fundamental factors fueling the strength. The Bank of International Settlements, aka the Central Bank of Central Banks, just reversed their stance on crypto. From calling it a bubble, a Ponzi scheme, and an environmental disaster, the BIS chief, Augustine Carlson, is now actively endorsing the creation and issuance of digital versions of national fiat currencies. To tell us more on that, we welcome Rumi Morales, partner at Outlier Ventures. So,
hi,
Rumi,
how are you?
This is an interesting stance that BIS has taken now. So it's doing a complete 180 on its position regarding crypto, and it's also coming out with their own. So this is essentially talking about the development of a central bank digital currency, which is basically no different than Libra, and which means that it is a centralized currency, which means that it can be censored, it can be frozen, it can be manipulated. And let's be real, this is a digital currency, not a cryptocurrency. So what is your stance and outlook on this?
I think the BIS was responding to two things here. The first being that many central banks themselves have been exploring digital currency for some time now. So as you mentioned, they're the central bank of central banks. They have to be very responsive to the central banks around the world and the fact that this is a movement and this is a technology that central banks all over are starting to explore in very meaningful ways. Now, the second effect that they are also responding to, you mentioned Libra, right, with Facebook's digital currency that they're launching. They are obviously very mindful of that and the fact that Facebook is launching a stable currency that perhaps can service millions, if not billions, of people around the world. But it's not just Facebook, right? The BIS, I believe in their annual report, also talked about Google and Tencent and Alibaba as other technology companies now getting into this space. So they're responding on those levels. I think they know that, you know, the genie is out of the bottle now. So for the BIS, it's like, well, what are your wishes, right? What are your three wishes in a world where digital currency is really becoming more prevalent?
Mm-hmm. And Rumi, it seems to bode well, obviously, for the industry that now the BIS and IMF are taking such an interest in cryptos and sort of legitimizing cryptocurrencies in a lot of people's eyes. But what do you think is their end goal here? Where do they see Bitcoin and other cryptos in relation to their own plans for a centralized currency?
I think for the central banks and the IMF, I say this not as a central banker or a person in a large, significant financial institution currently, but I have to imagine they just want to be able to keep on doing what they have been doing. They want to be able to promote financial stability and security all around the world. I have to think that, you know, the volatility that we were talking about earlier around Bitcoin really concerns them as they think about what will digital currencies do in the future. So I'm guessing that as they move toward putting more fiat in digital form themselves, that they can provide a more secure alternative for people that might be utilizing Bitcoin today, and so that Bitcoin becomes not a need to have, but a nice to have, and perhaps a less superior format to digital currencies that are more ubiquitous and supported by governments around the world.
But how will this actually solve any of the problems that are currently faced by the fiat currencies existing today? Because from what they're proposing, this is no different than just taking your standard fiat currency and just digitizing it.
You know, evolution, especially financial evolution, takes its time. I'm sitting here in Chicago where, let's not forget, you still have people at the Board of Trade trading with open outcry, with hand gestures, even though we're now talking about Bitcoin trading. So I don't mind at all that the central banks are discussing this. There will be problems in the future, just as there have been problems in the past. The important thing here is that they are embracing this type of technology innovation. They're trying to include more people in a more democratic way of providing finance around the globe, especially perhaps the people that cannot access the capital markets as easily as others can today. So I take this as an overall positive step in the right direction.
Now, let's move on over to XRP. XRP has tremendous potential, but it has since taken quite a hit recently. It had a huge sell-off recently, trading down to 40 cents, now that after 1 billion XRPs were unlocked and on the move. And speculation is that these XRPs belong to a Ripple exec, and they were intentionally keeping XRP prices low in order to beckon more clients to leverage the XRapid into their operations. So do you think there is some sort of price manipulation going on here?
You know, in the cryptocurrency market, every day it wouldn't be a regular day without some speculation one way or the other. I will say this, you know, full disclosure, I previously led the venture arm of the CME Group, and we invested in Ripple Series A round back over 4 years ago now in early 2015. And I was an observer on Ripple's board. So let's not get carried away necessarily imagining that Ripple or other firms are in some secret cave somewhere plotting for their own self-interest. Ripple's a very has a long tenure in this space. It has a very professional board. These are not a group of management making their decisions in isolation. I say this now having no association with Ripple, but just based on my past interaction with them, that collectively I think they've always been working towards their long-term vision of helping people, helping the world really transmit value, just the way that the world transfers information today.
Rumi Morales of Outlier Ventures, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That's it for this time. You can catch BoomBust on youtube.com/boombustrt. See you next time.